This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, September 10th, 2020. I'm Caleb Brown. Even before this summer's protests across the country calling for reforms of police departments in the U.S., dozens of states have been moving in the direction of reducing penalties for criminal infractions and making moves to make it easier for the formerly incarcerated to get their lives back. Robert Ault is president of the Buckeye Institute. This week, we talked about his new research detailing how states altered their criminal codes in 2019, both the good and the bad. We're looking at 2019. A lot of reforms have happened in 2020, but we're not here to talk about those specifically. But what was the general trend in states when it comes to criminal justice reform?
Well, I think overall there was, while there are certain exceptions, the majority of states continued to liberalize their law, their criminal justice laws, and I think there were a few themes that you saw that earned support in multiple states. So, sentencing reform, bail reform, drug reform, civil asset forfeiture reform, and felon enfranchisement. Those were all big areas in 2019.
So, with respect specifically to felon enfranchisement, I'm speaking to you from Kentucky. The governor of Kentucky signed an executive order restoring a variety of rights to people who were formerly incarcerated. What did other states do?
So, if you take a look, Illinois passed a law which directed Illinois County jails and local election officials to establish processes for allowing detainees who were awaiting trial to cast ballots by mail. Nevada passed a law maintaining the voting rights of those convicted of a crime who are not currently in prison, and it restored voting rights to those convicted of a felony immediately upon the release. New Jersey also passed a law just before Christmas restoring voting rights to felons on probation and parole. And then I think that probably the state that got the most attention with regard to felon enfranchisement was Florida. So Florida in 2018 had a ballot initiative, which passed by a 64.5% supermajority, entitled the Voting Rights Restoration for Felons Initiative, which amended the state constitution. So that went into effect. Then in June of 2019, Governor DeSantis signed a law which required felons to repay all financial obligations associated with their criminal record, including court fees, fines, and restitution, before they could regain the right to vote. That was challenged in a flurry of lawsuits and was enjoined. Florida has appealed that decision to the 11th Circuit. So that's still, we're still awaiting to see how that comes out. And then finally, Colorado law previously barred felons serving prison terms or parole from voting or registering to vote in any election. The House there passed a bill in the summer of 2019, re-enfranchising those serving a parole sentence by clarifying certain features of the law.
Now, on drug reform, last year, Colorado, and this is pretty striking, really, reduced personal drug possession of fewer than 4 grams from a felony to a misdemeanor. Now, you might say, but marijuana is legal there. No, this is Schedule I drugs that are defined by the DEA as having no medical value and a high potential for abuse. So that would include LSD, peyote, mushrooms, heroin. I guess cocaine is a Schedule II drug technically, but other drugs, and prescription drugs, which are typically Schedule II or lower drugs.
Yes. So I think this was probably the most sweeping drug reform in the country. As you noted, up to 4 grams of Schedule I and Schedule II, and Schedule II is more, as you suggested, I mean, that really gets to sort of the opioids are included in that, and that reduces it to a misdemeanor. And the law, you know, expressly was intended to reduce incarceration for low-level drug offenders. But, you know, unlike what we've seen in a lot of other states, which tended to limit those reforms to marijuana in Colorado. This, again, applied to Schedule 1 and Schedule 2. The marijuana, my understanding, and I'd have to look back at the law and verify, did, I think, have criminal penalties for possession above certain levels in Colorado. And my recollection, I'd have to verify, is that they increased those levels as well. So this was sort of a, you know, broad across the board. But in doing so, you're looking at Colorado joined six states that that did drug reform in 2019. So you had Illinois, for instance, which you know, they expressly stated that they were looking to treat marijuana in a manner similar to alcohol. That was sort of their goal with regard to it. So they were one of the multiple states. Hawaii acknowledged that dozens of states have already decriminalized the use of medical marijuana and therefore decriminalized possession up to 3 grams, but established that possession of such amount is punishable by a $130 fine. Florida relaxed its medical marijuana restrictions by redefining medical use to include essentially smoking, smokable forms of marijuana. Previously, that hadn't been permitted under the medical marijuana statute. And then New Mexico and New York also engaged in some reform of their marijuana laws. New Mexico reduced the penalties for first-time possession of up to a half an ounce to a criminal misdemeanor. And New York amended its penal code to reduce penalties for first and second degree possession of marijuana products. So quite a bit of action with regard to drug reforms across the states in 2019.
All right. So some states strengthened penalties. Alaska, you noted, is a big outlier. What did Alaska do?
So Alaska, it's sort of interesting. Once again, most states took to liberalizing, but Alaska passed a comprehensive tough on crime bill. And my understanding is the governor specifically ran on that. He had emphasized in his election campaign in 2018 public safety and support for law enforcement after Alaska saw its crime rate increase in Anchorage homicide. Hit record levels in 2017, which was right after they had passed a previous criminal justice reform bill. So essentially, the law passed in Alaska increases penalties for sex offenders. With regard to drug offenses, it returns distribution of narcotics such as heroin, cocaine, and methamphetamines to higher level felonies, restores the state's earlier anti-methamphetamine manufacturing provisions. It also enhanced sentences, shifted what was a Class B misdemeanor, previously was 0 to 10 days, is now 0 to 90 days. So pretty much, increase the ratchet, across the board, on a number of different, whether it's what classified as a crime, what the crime classification was, and what the sentences were for committing those crimes.
There were a number of states that moved on, child sex crimes, sex offender crimes generally, and what can happen to those people's records. In Tennessee, you note that the governor signed a law that effectively prohibits a sex offender convicted of a crime involving a child from having an overnight visit in a home in which a child resides. Now, however helpful that might be, it seems blatantly unconstitutional.
Well, and based upon that, your intuition, ends up bearing out to what's happened in the courts. Three plaintiffs challenged the statute on the grounds that it violated their parental rights, and a federal district judge temporarily enjoined the law in 2019. And it, last time I checked, there's been no further action in that case, but that case got held up. In a similar fashion, New York strengthened its protections for minors against felony sex offenders. In August of 2019, the state amended its domestic relations law to create a rebuttable presumption that a child should not be placed in the custody of or have unsupervised visits with a person who has been convicted of a felony sex offense. So somewhat similar to what we saw in Tennessee there.
So what about the expungement of criminal records? You note California, Colorado, Delaware, New Jersey, and West Virginia all made adjustments there. Before we get to what they did specifically, was there something in particular that was driving a lot of this, or is this just a lot of states making similar decisions about this?
I think part of this is sort of the next step that you see with regard to criminal justice reform. We've seen a lot of emphasis, I think, in the reform movement in recent years, a recognition that a felony conviction oftentimes constitutes, you know, sort of a scarlet F on someone's record. If you take a look at the collateral consequences that come from getting that felony conviction, in a number of cases, you've got situations where maybe the legislature has made the determination that particular offenses should no longer even be classified as a felony. But you have individuals who have previous convictions for those on their records. They're still branded a felon. That still goes with them when they're seeking to get employment or so forth. And the consequences of that can be pretty significant. So, addressing that. The other issue that I think has motivated legislatures is just the sense that, look, you know, if someone has actually, if they've had a criminal offense, but they've ended up keeping their nose clean for decades, why is it that we're still hanging that over their heads and having that be an impairment in terms of their ability, you know, to get jobs, housing, et cetera, where, you know, that may come up in their records. So I think that's motivated it. The other thing is that California actually, if you take a look, passed a swath of criminal reform bills in 2019, and broad expungement was one of them. There, they actually require the state to take the onus to go through records and to remove and to expunge criminal convictions. In most states, the onus is upon the offender to go and to petition the court for that. Whereas in California, they actually, in a large number of cases, put the requirement on the state justice system to go ahead and go through and institute those expungement proceedings themselves.
One thing of note, Illinois, in legalizing, taxing, and regulating marijuana in a manner similar to alcohol, this was done by the General Assembly. This wasn't done by a voter initiative, as it has been in most other states. This sounds like let's get rid of prohibition so we can make some money. Is that basically what Illinois did?
I think it was probably a combination of things. Yes, number one, I mean, Illinois is drowning in a sea of red ink, as we all know, and in particular, their pension systems are in dire shape. So they've been looking to raise taxes however they can. I know they've been seeking a constitutional amendment to be able to modify the flat, you know, what's functionally the flat tax in that state. So, you know, this seemed like a cash cow to them, I'm sure. The other pressure, I think, that weighed on Illinois' decision, this followed in 2018. You had, I believe it was, you saw the Citizens Initiative in Michigan that legalized marijuana. And as you recall, I think we were sitting together last year doing the recap of state laws. And my one prediction was that Michigan was kind of the canary in the coal mine in terms of the trend line on this. It was your first state that was, you know, this was not, you know, a West Coast state. This wasn't, you know, Mountain High, Colorado. This was, you know, sort of a bread and butter Midwest state. And what seemed to motivate Michigan's legalization or decriminalization efforts was Canada's. And there was concern, you know, talking to folks in Michigan, there seemed to be concern that if Canada had legalized marijuana, that you would have residents going across the border, and they didn't want, you know, to have people, you know, sort of increasing the number of people who were driving, potentially driving under the influence or the like. And so they decided, well, better to go ahead and you know, reduce the regulations here in Michigan. And that also seemed to motivate New York, by the way. So a lot of the border states with Canada ended up modifying it. But once Michigan went ahead, you know, I think you're going to see the other states start to tumble, you know, as well. So Illinois, I think, was predictable based upon what happened last year with Michigan.
Yeah, you see it's sort of a cascade where states next to states that have legalized marijuana are either feeling a bit of FOMO, perhaps, when it comes to revenue, or that may be driven by some legitimate safety concerns.
Yeah, no, I think there are a variety, but Canada, the sort of extrinsic pressure from Canada seems to have been a big motivating factor. But I think, you know, the other thing, I think you've probably seen a tipping point in terms of the debate. If you take a look, even the Trump administration came in with, you know, under General Sessions, with, you know, a much more tough on drug crimes perspective. But even they ended up softening their perspective. Again, keep in mind, it is kind of a hash, if you'll pardon the pun, in terms of the federal state relationship on this. You still have the federal crimes on the books. You just have a general policy of non-enforcement in states that have relaxed their policy with regard to marijuana. But, you know, prior to, I think, recent actions in Michigan and elsewhere, I think there had been a general concern that at some point the feds could go ahead and flip the switch and resume prosecutions with regard to states that had medical or recreational marijuana. I think at this point, there are so many states that have changed their policy, it would be very difficult to have that happen. Ultimately, I think to get continuity, though, this is going to require Congress to take action on this and to revise federal policy. But, you know, given the number of states that have liberalized their policy, it just doesn't seem likely that you're going to see the ratchet go back the other way.
Robert Ault is president of Ohio's Buckeye Institute. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast anywhere you please and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.